Hello, kingly brothers and heroic husbands from around the planet. Welcome to this episode of the Be the Husband She Brags About podcast. In this episode, we welcome in Dewey Freeman. Dewey is a sought-after teacher, trainer, licensed therapist, and equine professional around the world. He has traveled to teach professionally in over 8 countries, has developed a practical attachment theory and human development theory that is taught to thousands of university students, has over 80,000 direct client hours, and co-founded both the Gestalt Equine Institute and the Gestalt Institute of the Rockies. He provides supervision to therapists and graduate students, does business and land consultations for new equine therapy sites, and models being a lifelong student to your passions. Gestalt and relational horsemanship are not just approaches to Dewey. They are how he walks through the world. He embodies both tenderness and strength in all his relations and work. His quality of contact and relationship with others is authentic and unique, and has many people coming from around the country and world to study with him. He has worked incredibly hard to master his arts and finds great joy in teaching honest students. Dewey is a true elder and mentor, and is exploring new horizons in facilitating men's growth work. Dewey Freeman, brother, it's an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Dewey, it's one of these questions that, you know, to ask an elder like yourself with such a potent, beautiful tapestry of life already lived, it can be a massive answer that can come. But I'm really curious, you know, What were your experiences in earlier life that has brought you to such a deep inner work within yourself that, excuse me, that has obviously, become an outward expression and mission in the world? But I'm just curious about those early days. What were the biggest formative experiences?
Wow. That's a big question. You're right. I have had probably 3 very significant big experiences, along with thousands of little ones or less big ones. Let me just mention them and then we can dive into any or all of them if we choose, and I'm open to doing that. When my mother was pregnant with me, 5 months into her pregnancy, she was diagnosed with tuberculosis. And this was late 1949. And at that time, tuberculosis was a very, it was a deadly disease. Her experience was one of incredible fear about whether or not I would live, whether she would live. And thankfully, we both did. When I was born, I was whisked away from her and didn't really get reunited with her until I was nearly 18 months old. Which, as you may know or guess, the level of attachment issues that would come from that, the level of what do you do with relationships, the level of is the world an okay place to be, all of those were issues that really, really affected my early life, and frankly still do at times. I will give my mother a tremendous amount of credit that she worked very hard and very hard to help me work through those. She was always willing to talk. And I can go into that more deeply if that seems to be appropriate. One thing I'll link to that, and obviously as an infant, I wasn't thinking about this, but later on in my life, when I started working with children. And I worked with a man named Foster Klein, who did some very early attachment work. That work, plus my early life in infancy, was at the core of me putting together some of the models that I put together and a lot of the work that I do. So that was huge. As a bit of an aside, I was around nature and animals a lot, and particularly horses growing up. So a lot of my attachment was there. So that also is much of the foundation of the work that I do. So that's sort of experience number one of the three. The second major experience was I had, in 1970, I had graduated from Akron University with a degree in mechanical engineering and physics. The following week, I was on the Kent State campus in Ohio. And I don't know if any of your listeners know or would remember this, but the National Guard opened fire on the students. We were protesting the Vietnam War and protesting in regards to civil rights. And I was in the middle of that crowd where four students were killed and seven were wounded. And I don't know if anyone's into music, but Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song about four dead in Ohio, that's what that song is about. And that actually took me away from working as an engineer or physicist. And I couldn't do that. It rocked my world. And a friend of mine asked me if I wanted to go work at a camp where they were doing Outward Bound. And I don't know if any of your listeners are familiar with Outward Bound, but it's a outdoor program that helps both young people and also now adults connect with nature, connect with group work, and sort of heal through those experiences. And then that was a shift for me working toward becoming an engineer to becoming a person who worked therapeutically with people. I went back to school after that and got a number of other degrees and lots of studying to get me where I'm at. And again, I'm willing to dive into that further. The third, and it was actually two incidences. This was in my late 30s and early 40s. My then wife and I were not married now. I'm in a very committed, wonderful relationship with another person. Had a child who was stillborn and was late pregnancy, stillborn. And then we tried to adopt a child because we were told not to have children. And the child that we were working on adopting was born anencephalic, which is no brain development. And we proceeded, and mostly I proceeded, to support the young mother who gave birth, and so that she could get medical care, and so that the little girl that was born could get medical care. And she lived to 14 months old. When many people ask me what was the shift particularly in my adult life, that era of time was profoundly difficult and profoundly disturbing, but also profoundly it changed who I am and helped me. I had to make a choice about whether to give up or whether to fight for my life and the life of those around me. And that's, up until then, I had not really made that choice. You know, I was going along just like a lot of men do. It's like, okay, I'm in this world, I'm living, I'm making a, I'm educated, I'm supporting my family. But getting to that place where there was a clear, clear choice about whether I give up and say I'm done because this is too hard, or whether I'm willing to, was willing to literally fight for my life and fight for the life of those around me. So those are really three of the biggest influences. There's a lot of smaller ones that get attached to those a lot of times when I, you know, I've had other losses, I've had some major challenges, but those are the three that I would say, when people say, Dewey, what shifted in you, or what changed, or what do you, you know, what do you attribute some of what you know to? Those are the three pieces that I connect into.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dewey, for sharing so profoundly. And just to share with you, I had tears to the back of my eyes because I can deeply resonate on a personal autobiographical level, just that choice.
Yeah.
I think it was early, mid 20s. Our daughter was first born. I think she was like 3-4 months old, and my whole day was permeated. The only escape was suicidal ideation. It just was like, okay, it was like, it seems crazy to me now. But I had my version of, okay, there's this grand zero choice, Mark, you've got to make.
Yeah, you make it. We all have to make that choice at some point.
If you're okay going there, Dewey, I'd love to know more, if you could tell me more, just what making that choice looked like. And it's the context. I'll just give a little bit of sacred context, because I know, like, listening to guys, you know, guys listening in and then one-on-one calls with them and in men's circles, there's a lot of pain out there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of guys are just, it's like the same shit, different days, really, really intensely hard. And, you know, and it's within that sacred context, I think, you know, a man like you that has so clearly leaned into that fire and has found a way. So if you could describe what making that choice looked like or felt like, if there was some process, I'll leave it to you to tell the story in your own words.
Sure. Well, clearly it was not overnight. Clearly it wasn't that I just woke up one morning and went, oh, I can do this. It actually became a bigger issue of that I would say is very existential. And the deep knowing that life is incredibly precious, and that we're incredibly, incredibly complicated beings. And the part of the miracle of life is actually death. Like putting those two pieces together, because I saw that, I've seen that numbers of times in my life. With people being shot, with people being injured, with people with trying to fight against that under certain situations. But the whole piece of seeing how fragile life is and whether I wanted to give in to that fragility or whether I wanted to, in many ways, embrace that fragility as a way, as a strength, as a knowing that we have so little time here. And am I going to collapse under what's happening, or am I going to move into a place of honoring death, actually? And what, here's what's interesting. I want to wrap around here a little bit, because this is a really important piece for me to say. In many ways, it's what soldiers deal with in war. And when many people hear me say that I was anti-Vietnam War, there's an underlying assumption that I'm against everything along that line. And what I will say is that I still remain anti-war. I don't want us to be in wars, and I have never been anti-soldier. And those two pieces to me are really important, because that willingness to fight for our lives and to fight for other people's lives when we need to do that, when that's really appropriate, is to me a hallmark of knowing who we are and knowing what is incredibly valuable to us. And I continue to do that. I continue to be willing to fight for my life and for the lives of other people that I value and that I love. And all the same, it's also incredibly important to me for that fight to be based on values of brotherhood, values of what I call the I, thou, we. And I'm happy to go into that. A lot of people they have a sense of what that is, but they don't really know what that is.
Please do. I'm really curious, actually, some part of your website, my preparations. Can you take me deeper as to what your meaning behind those seemingly three simple words put together? Yeah. But I'm imagining there's a real nugget of profundity there.
Yeah, that means a lot to me, those three words. We can go through life having what I call I-it relationships versus I-that relationships. And it's always important to me to give credit where credit is due. So the person who came up with the concept of I-thou was a man named Martin Buber. In the late 1800s. Interestingly enough, one of the reasons he came up with that was a relationship he had as a child with a horse. So interestingly, it came out through that relationship. And what I vow is the underlying belief that the other being, whether it be another man, whether it be a woman, whether it be a child, whether it be an animal, whether it be nature, whether it be a horse, whether it be whatever the other is that we get that the other being has just as much of an experience and just as deep of an experience of life and a a very profound experience from their perspective that is oftentimes incredibly different than our experience. And even though there is difference, that experience is as valued and as important as whatever experience that I have. So relationally, what I want to be able to hold is, for instance, even between you and I mean, we're in two different countries at this point. It's two different times, very different time zones, which we've tripped over a little bit getting here. And but that your experience in life is whatever it is just as deep and just as valued and just as profound as mine. And when we go into what's called an I-it relationship, what I'm doing is objectifying the other being, whether it be another person, whether it be a woman, whether it be another person from another culture than we're in. The I-it relationship is actually the core of all the isms, of all the racisms, of all the sexisms, of all of all the hatred in the world, actually, where we're objectifying the other. And so what the I-thou relationship is working from a very deep place of not objectifying the other being that we're in contact with. And that Martin Buber came up with that concept originally. What we have done is add the we to that concept. And maybe the best way to explain it is when we're doing something together, we become a we. So if one of my horses' name is Moondash, he's a racing quarter horse, he's huge. He's very fast, he's very agile. And when he and I are riding, and please notice, I said he and I. It's not I'm not riding him. When we're moving, and like I might say to someone, I could say two things. I could say, "Well, I'm going to trot Moon," or I could say, "We're going to go trot." So energetically, what we're doing is we're allowing our cores to connect energetically so that when we're moving together, we are a we. So from a relational place, when we're in deep intimacy with another, there's a level of we that's always there. I live with a woman named Kimberly. We live in a one-room cabin up on the side of a mountain. And, you know, we live here. We are working together. And she's actually out. We have a little camper trailer that she's doing another thing online right now. But it's like I can still feel her energy. So there's like an overlapping of energy to where it's like we're together. And that, is that making sense as I'm saying this piece?
It's making total sense. The first thing that I would share is like, well, definitely all the guys I'm working with. I think the I-thou, the I-it. The I-it for me, when you were speaking that, I was almost hopping on my cushion wanting to intrude and go, oh my God, that's like just me for my first 12 years of marriage. Get you up to speed. It's like a few years ago, Dewey, I had a marriage breakdown, breakthrough, just shitstorm that I had to get through, my own inner shitstorm. So it's podcasts and my work now, it was all birthed from that. But that just was like, okay, that's Mark and how Mark used to project. I have a deep grief actually, just when it's so explicitly mirrored back to me, you know, that level of how I objectified, I was not relating with Matilda. There was no Matilda. There was this, I actually have spoke to her. It's like, I made a monster off you. And like that it in Matilda became, for me, I could describe it. It was like this jealous monster, this over-possessive, you know, whore in her and her effing abandonment wounds, you know, a whore. It's not my fault. You know, it's not my fault. Her parents got divorced. That's why she can't trust me. That's why. And it's like, I excused my entire lack of integrity as a man, my entire lack of having any core. So when you say it like that, the I, it, it's like this object. I own that. It's like I made a monster of my wife to hide behind. The I, thou, I'm getting, like, little bit by little bit the last few years, like, softening into that. I'm passionately curious to hear more about the process of we. I think I'm getting really, really good at the I, thou, honoring my wife, honoring my wife, her uniqueness, her spiritual core essence, you know, in the moment to moment, every day. But I'm really curious about transitioning from maybe that level of I, thou to we. Can you describe that transition? I don't even know how to formulate, like, if there's a description of that process from one stage to the next.
Sure. That actually is a great question. And thank you for being vulnerable enough to share that piece. We as beings are made primarily as from energy. We're energy in a certain form. We have the ability, and actually, let me back up slightly here. Let me back up just a little bit. One of the pieces that I work with extensively is what I call contact. I have been a professor at numbers of different universities, sort of a total of about 35 years. One university I was at for 31. And I would joke with my students that 95% of the time, the right answer to whatever I ask is contact. Whatever question I ask, the right answer is contact. Let me define it. Contact is attuned to the other, where our energetic, emotional, physical, and or spiritual boundaries touch another. So let me say it again. It's a moment in time where we're attuned with another, where energetic, emotional, physical, and or spiritual boundaries touch another. When our boundaries touch, and in this case, from this perspective, boundaries are something we actually need to be able to make contact, because if we don't have a boundary, there's no contact to be made. If you could imagine right now, if you're sitting in the audience listening, if you hold your hands maybe 18 inches apart and slowly bring them together, you'll feel some place where there's some warmth between your hands. And in between your hands, there's an energetic boundary between each hand where they're touching, or that energy is touching. If you move your hands closer to where it's skin on skin, the boundaries are skin to where we touch. So we have to have boundaries to be able to make contact. Does that make sense so far with that, Mark?
Yeah, it's making sense. And you're bringing me back 11 years to my Reiki training days, when I remember putting the hands, that exercise together. I remember the cynical, I shared this with you. I remember how bloody cynical I was, because I was sitting in a room just judging every last single person that was feeling this energy, and I couldn't. But I'm glad to report into the space. There's been an upregulation of my sensitivity. I could feel it today. So I'm like, it just took me like 11 or 12 years to get here, but I've shifted over a decade. So yeah, I'm enjoying the lovely practical example, and I hope guys listening in have enjoyed that as well and found it useful.
Yeah. So, well, thank you. And the piece here that I think is important to understand is when we create contact, that's the beginning of creating a we. And so a lot of our work has to do with creating contact. So let me throw this one piece in here too. And this is a piece that I put together over time. Is contact, when contact between two beings becomes predictable and trustworthy, that creates connection. When connection between two people becomes consistent and dependable and trustworthy, that's what really creates relationship. That's actually the essence of a relationship. When relationship between two people is consistent and dependable and trustworthy, that's what creates intimacy. People oftentimes want to go from contact to intimacy without anything in between. And in the process of intimacy, what we're actually doing is we can learn how to do this. This is a thing that we can learn, is what we're doing is creating an opening, the other to step into that energetic opening. And when they do, then we're available for contact. So when that happens, that's what creates the we, because the energetic opening allows us to not only touch another, but it actually allows us to hold another energetically. If you wanted to look at this from a place of sort of practicality, think about this, because you mentioned the most of the listeners on your podcast are both men and women in committed long-term relationships. Think about and just allow yourselves to feel the difference between, say, putting your hand on your wife's shoulder or your partner's shoulder. And the difference between that and just the idea of gently opening your arms and allowing her to step into your arms. And when she does that, you're totally available for contact as a place to hold her energetically, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. And so we move in and out of that process of energetically and physically sometimes being we. But then when we're not, for instance, holding our wives, or they're holding us, and we, you know, we're numbers of feet apart, you can still feel that level of intimacy and that level of being held on an energetic, emotional, spiritual level.
Dewey, so. I'd really love, I'm actually so captivated by how you've set this up. So if I'm hearing you correctly, it's like the most common thing is we try to go from that initial contact straight to intimacy. We sort of skip all the juice along the way that needs to be the foundation for it. I'm from a mechanistic perspective, working with guys, I personally on my healing journey, I always found it super useful. You know, by nature, nurture, trauma, you know, the modern culture, how it sort of takes us out of our feminine as men so much and runs us into our rational mind. I find there's this superpower of the rational mind for guys. But could you, in your experience over so many years, and speaking with guys specifically here, what does the opposite of that look like? I definitely want to hear more and go deeper into how you set that container and invite in, but what are some warning signs? Like, what are the classic ways that guys unwittingly do the opposite? Unwittingly, you know, as you said, sort of like put the hand on the shoulder without going at it the other way. That's a softer, more connection enriching way. Could you speak to that, if there's some like bullet point signs that for a guy like myself that I can recognize? It's like, oh, you know, yeah, I'm just after doing what Dewey said. Oh, like force of habit takes me over. What would the bullet points of those behaviorally look like?
What are the warning signs where we go,
what are the warning signs? Well, that sound doesn't happen, but I know my wife growls at me and snarls at me. And I think every guy has his version, whether he likes it or not, where she just like gives him the look and gives him the growl. But yeah, what are the signs that could empower us as men, as conscious men, to take it upon ourselves, you know, before we get the snarl, that we can sort of catch ourselves, and even if we get caught in the moment doing it, was like, oh, okay, handbrake up, I've noticed myself, I can choose to disengage with this behavior?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me wrap back around a little bit to what you said, where you said, okay, we make contact and then we want to be intimate and we skip everything in the middle. That's actually one of the warning signs. And that's the place where, you know, it's like, you know, we go out on a date, we hold hands and we want to fuck. It's like, okay, guys, there's something in between here. The biggest, and this piece is general, so it's not quite the bullet point, but I will get to there. One of the biggest pieces that we do is when we go from, okay, I want to go from contact to, and we skip everything in between. When we do that, we are objectifying the other. So one of the biggest warning signs is watching what you do as a process of objectification. So when I look at my partner, and we've been together nearly a decade now, it's like, do I think she's beautiful? Absolutely. But I'm not walking around going, oh, nice ass. What I'm walking around looking at is the beauty of her entire being, not just the beauty of her body. So that's one piece. That leads into many times our process of separating our inner sensory process from our bodies. So one of the biggest things we do as men is we objectify ourselves. We do not have an I-thou relationship with ourselves. So then when we get into that, what we do is become human doers instead of human beings. And I'm sure that more than one person on here has heard that last phrase. But our biggest piece of work is not objectifying who we are. And that process is, do we know what we feel? Do we have an inner sense of what's going on with us? Are we asking for something from whomever we're with so that we don't have to feel? Are we doing something in such a way that we don't have to express what's going on with us? And do we even have the awareness of what's going on with us? So those are the kinds of things that we begin looking at, because the bottom line is that when we objectify the other, we are objectifying ourselves. People don't get that at first, but that is what's happening. One of the underlying pieces to look at with that is, do we trust the other person and do we trust ourselves? So one of my questions to all the men on here is, do you trust yourself? And do you even know what that means? Do you trust yourself to work through a hard time with your wife and come out okay? Do you trust yourself to be able to check in with your own body? And many men have no clue what's happening in their body. When do you trust yourself to check in with your body and feel the sensations that are running through your body? Do you trust yourself to share your hurts? Do you trust yourself enough to be vulnerable? All of the stuff that we do is that we, when we walk in and we're objectifying ourselves and the other beings, is what's happening. The reason, underlying reason we're doing that, has to do with we're protecting something. So the underlying question has to do with, what are you protecting? And that's, so the two pieces that I, two or three pieces that I would say that really connect in there, Mark, are, one, the first thing is noticing it. Like, how aware are you that you're objectifying either yourself or the other? How aware of you then of what's happening in your body while you're doing that? And then the other piece is, do you trust yourself? Can you be vulnerable? Do you know what's going on? And then can you express it? So the biggest piece, and so let me jump into this a little bit. The term toxic masculinity gets thrown out there a lot. And what I will say is, I don't use that term. I don't buy that term. I don't think that term's accurate. And what's happening, though, and this is the question for people to ask themselves, is, what are you protecting when you are objectifying? Because that's the reason we objectify, is we're trying to protect something. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I just find it such a beautifully potent question. What are you protecting? What comes up immediately for me, and I have this awareness now. I'm like 3.5 years every single week being grilled by, you know, powerful men in men's groups and my own coaching, etc., etc. But again, those 12 years, and it still comes up, of course, like it catches me off guard. But like, what was I protecting for years? I was protecting from such a feeling of inadequacy. As a lover, I had so much sexual shame. My sort of protecting myself, like, it was easier to judge my queen for what she wasn't doing. There again, objectify her with the story to avoid just feeling shame. I think that was probably like the base level emotion that I was protecting myself from experiencing, with probably hundreds of subtle variations off that. But I just wanted to speak that as a live awareness, and it still shows up. I know now, anytime I go into a closure, that's the thing, my closure, my judgment, the bodyguard that comes in front of me between myself and Matilda, I suppose, between the I, thou, and transitioning to we, there's this part of my persona that just comes in. And it's protecting me from feeling shame. So I just wanted to lead with that. And I'm really, really loving just how you're describing this with such crystal clarity for me and for every guy listening in, Dewey.
So, well, thank you. And so when you speak to the men that you speak to, how do you define shame? So And what you brought up around shame and sexuality, men's sexuality, is huge. I mean, it's like gigantic. And I'd be really curious about how you define shame. Then I'd also like to jump into this whole masculine and feminine thing, and sexuality and shame around sexuality, because it's such a big fucking thing out there. It's really big.
Yeah, bring it on. The funny thing, and this is just to make it real, with you and with guys listening in, as you ask me the question, there's like a fog of shame that came up in my system as I was asking, because part of that, this is just an interesting aside, but just want to be totally transparent with you, Dewey, to share this. I've a long-standing fear of being questioned. It used to devastate me in university days. I was an incredibly high-achieving academic. I could study, but when somebody put me on the spot, so it's interesting, you just asked me how I defined shame. That part, that exact same part, you know, like, what are you protecting? That exact same part just came in there and gave me a shudder of shame. I can feel it in my belly, sort of up into my chest. It's sort of gone now as I'm speaking to it. But it was trying to protect me from, oh, fuck. I mean, asked the audience, am I going to get the question right? I'm sharing that because I know the guys I have resonated most, Trevor would be one of them. I've introduced to you by Trevor Boehm, you know, powerful men like that, just no bullshit, just share what's actually live in the moment. So I just wanted to, I found that so revealing for myself. So I'm just practicing the same here.
Before you jump into anything further, can I respond to what you just said?
Yeah, please do. Let's roll on the mats here in the dojo.
And also, I mean, just for information, Trevor Boehm and I work together. We live like 30 minutes apart, and very good friends. And yeah, I love what Trevor brings. So just kudos to him and what he brings, and thank you for mentioning him, just out of support for him and what he brings. The other piece that I would say to you is what you just did is exactly what men need to do. And please understand, I was not on any level trying to put you on the spot. I just wanted to, it's like there's so many definitions of shame out there. I just was curious what definition you were working with. Well, what you did around just saying, wow, this is my process right now. That's a big deal. And that's exactly what we need to do. And what you just did was create an I that we relationship from that perspective with you and me, because now we can work on this together and whatever it is. And so it's sort of the perfect example of what happens when we can, as two people, be incredibly respectful, be incredibly kind to each other, and share our vulnerabilities. Because had you not said that, I wouldn't have known what was going on. And I get it. I mean, I totally get it. And I really appreciate you jumping on that the way you did. That was a great example of how to be. Mm-hmm. And
Thank you. I'm really appreciating you holding the space for that, Ewan. Again, just being in your presence, it's relatively easy for me. So thank you for receiving that. And it's to speak, you know, it's the part of me. There's also this other part, and this has definitely been a new part that men's work has brought to me. There's also this other part that couldn't give a shit. You know, it's like, I'm not being put in the spot. I know, you asked a simple question. It was a direct question. And there's another part that can also simultaneously go, I could just answer the question, and I could have. I really, that's not just for guys listening in. I know, Dewey, with the level of work you do, that's not me recovering from some point. You know, it's, oh, fuck, I got all vulnerable. There just is this simultaneous part that's like also badass can, you know, just get on with things. But I have emotions coming up all day, every day, just like that. So just giving a little bit of that process to answer your question, Dewey. The definition I would give, how would I describe shame? Quite simply, I think the most common way I would speak to guys is this background feeling of inadequacy, that you're just not enough as a man. And I think that's the clearest way. I might pepper in other ways of describing it, but that's probably my foundational way of speaking to it.
Sure. And that actually makes a lot of sense. So let me go with that, because that's a what I'll do is a yes and to that. It's like, yeah, that's correct. Makes a lot of sense. One of the biggest pieces that creates shame is that we, and developmentally, since, I mean, this is a big piece of what I teach and around the developmental stuff, is it's about between 2 and 4 years old that we learn how to do what I call separate personhood and behavior. And if we don't learn how to do that, then that's what creates shame, is it's a lack of separation between personhood and behavior. So let me give two examples. One, and when I have a double master's degree, one of them is, I had a professor, one of them is in special education. Had a professor walk in. This is actually late 1974, so this is a while ago. And the classroom was sort of stadium seating, and he walks in and gets behind the podium, and he has sunglasses on. And I mean, nothing would indicate anything other than he was wearing sunglasses. And he asked us to introduce ourselves, and we did. And then when we were done, he said, would you all please stay in those seats the rest of the term, because I can't see you all. I can't see anything. And then he went on to speak about that he is a man who cannot see. He's not a blind man. And it's nuanced, but it's like there's a difference between a man who is blind or a man whose eyes don't work the way that other people's eyes work, and being a blind man, because it's a huge difference between that. And so that separation between who we are and the mistakes we make have to be, or the failures we have, or even the positive things that happen to us. There's a real difference between what happens with a kid when they throw their oatmeal on the floor. You know, maybe they're 3.5 years old, and they throw their oatmeal on the floor and their parent says, bad boy. That's a very different message than saying, sweetie, I love you, and it's not okay to throw your oatmeal on the floor. And when we can come in, both to ourselves and to others, where we can say, you know, I love you, and I'm really struggling getting an erection right now. Or I love you and I don't know what to do with this. Or I love myself and I care about what happens and I'm stuck. Those things are really huge. So what the shame that makes a way to speak it to me is not knowing how to separate who we are as beings from behavior and what we're able to do or not do. Or that another way, and some people say it this way, is that shame is not being able to go, oh, I made a mistake. What we do when we're shaming ourselves is say, I am a mistake, which is the same kind of concept. Does that make some sense to you?
It's making profound sense. It just brings us like a technical clarity. I think my definition, I was like, yeah, cool. It's a good, it informs me, but it's very general. My rational mind is like geeking out. I'm a total nerd for stuff like this. I'm rapidly, I have like a page full of notes. The guys listening in will always know. I so often, I refer to guests and say, oh, look, I've had total, my A4 page in front of me. I can't read the notes I had typed out for you coming in with the amount of notes that are on it. What's really jumping out of me, and I love, it's like, you know, there's that masculine part of us that is like, can we get an if then? Can we get some, like, the skill set or an if then in communication that guys can grab hold of? There's an amount of deep philosophical uncovering here at the root of it, which is so profound and so beautiful and essential. But the really practical way that you were describing how to communicate in a sensitive way that does not shame. I love you, and
yes,
it's not okay what you just said. I struggle for years, and I still find it like the anger when it comes up in me, classic Mr. Nice Guy. And I know so many guys listening in, it's like this struggle of like, how do we just say the thing that one part of our nervous system is like, you're totally out of line for that, or that's just not okay. Okay. Like we have this awareness, but I know myself and guys listening in, it's like, we just create such a hole for ourselves so regularly when it's like just not being able to land that clarity tactfully, that our beautiful women can feel our heart. And that just is, that's so powerful. I love you, and this other thing is going to be communicated as well. I'm just excited now for just even in my own marriage, like actually especially in my own marriage, I'm excited at just how simple that is in the setup of that sentence. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece.
Well, thank you. And there's a thousand ways to say I love you. Sometimes we just say it. Sometimes we, you know, I say, hey, babe. Sometimes I'll just touch her kindly. And we want to do that. And this is part of what creates the we want to do that all the time. So when I tell Kimberly, who's my partner, when I tell her you're beautiful, it's like, babe, I love you and you're beautiful. Not just that you're beautiful. Because a lot of people in the world could say that she's beautiful. But it's like, I want those two things connected. I love you, babe, and the dinner you made is just fantastic. And sometimes I say it in words, and sometimes it's, you know, I just like, while we're eating, I'll just touch your leg and say, this meal is unbelievable. So there's different ways to say that and do that. And so so we can, you know, talk about that in a lot of different ways. And that actually goes way back to attachment. Three things we want in attachment are food, touch, and movement. And well, if we want to do, I mean, it's like, and Mark, I know that if we lived close enough, it'd be like, hey, let's grab lunch. You know, it's like we do those things. Let's have a coffee. That's the food part. The touch part is the contact part. It can be physical touch. It can be emotional touch. the movement is movement of energy through our bodies, or even physical movement. It could be walking, but if you look at what emotions are, it's like E-motion. It's like energy moving through our bodies. And there's always that going on. And it's those things that create the connection, and those things that are sort of the antidote to shame. And so that makes sense. And then I sort of want to jump into this other thing, if it's okay with you, around masculine and feminine, like it's set up.
I'm feeling the fire in you. I was just really wondering, because what, 10 minutes ago, you were really on fire. It's like, oh, masculine, feminine. So I'm not going to hold you back, Dewey. You're not going to be, I'm getting this feeling. You're just not going to be a happy guy by the end of this podcast conversation if you don't get to speak in it. So fire away, sir.
Let me share why I do get passionate about this, because I think in part the way that some words are used out there today have to do with helping to create shame in men. And I want to speak to that because that's so important to me. When I'm speaking this, I'm not putting anybody down. I'm not on any level. It's just a different perspective. When men are told that your kind, gentle, caring parts are feminine, when I get told that, I feel disrespected. When I say to a woman who I care about, when she's fiery and strong and powerful, if I say, yeah, that's your masculine, that feels disrespectful to her from my perspective. And the example I use is if a mama bear, and I mean, where I live, there are bears. I saw one like 2 days ago up here. So when a mama bear is protecting, say, two cubs, she doesn't go, I think I'm going to jump into my masculine and be strong here. Mama bear is just a mama bear. And you stay away from her cubs or you get ripped apart. I mean, it's sort of that simple. And there's a quality in I'll speak about women first here. There's a quality and a qualitative difference with women being incredibly powerful and strong. And I want the women that I'm with and that I know that are my, you know, Kimberly, my partner, and I have tons of women friends who I want them to be strong. I want them to be powerful. And I want them to have that incredible feminine power. I'm around also tons of men who, I mean, like some of my very best friends are like ex-MMA fighters and third degree black belts in jiu-jitsu and, you know, men who can lift 700 pounds. I mean, they're powerful men. And it's like, they're also unbelievably kind and gentle. And it's like, it's a masculine gentleness. There's a qualitative difference in their kindness and gentleness. And it's like, I don't want to label that in a way that it takes away from the masculinity of the gentleness that they have. And I don't want to label a woman that if a woman is powerful, where it takes away from the power that she has by labeling it something besides who she is. And so it's a different perspective on the masculine and feminine, and people can agree with it or not agree with it. It's okay with me. One of the things I often say in this work is that there's so many terms and words that get thrown about, like masculine, feminine, ego, spirituality, the divine, all of those kinds of words where nobody really knows what they mean. And when there's a word that has to be defined every time we use it, it probably isn't a word that's going to help us communicate very well. So, and again, I mean, I have degrees up the yin yang. If someone, you know, has the right to talk about ego and knowing about it and studying it, it's like, I might be one of those people, but it's like, I don't use that word because it has so many meanings. And there's other words that I try and stay away from because we don't know what they mean because they have so many meanings. You know, and again, there's the one example of, it's like a mama bear doesn't go, gee, I think I'm going to drop into my masculine and save my baby cubs.
It's very interesting that the timing of this, Dewey, for myself is very, what's the word? Synchronistic, is that the word? It's, I just had my previous guest, Justin Patrick Pierce, speaking about divine masculine and feminine, but in his work, he was actually shifting away from those terms as well. For reasons like that, it's like, oh, it's just like, you know, there's this inherent part that is just, you know, within the male. It's like, oh, no, I don't want to relate with feminine. There's some, and vice versa. Interestingly, he went with himself and his wife find alpha and omega as terms. And to share with you, I was like, I mentioned the alpha and the omega idea to my beautiful queen, and she's like, oh, no way. It's like, she studied wild flora and fauna at college. She's like, alpha and omega? It's like, I'm never going to be an omega. I don't like those terms. I'm not doing that. I'm good with masculine and feminine, but don't give me that other stuff. I'm bringing that in because it's like, it is this part of like words get so loaded. And it's interesting, you know, one guy, he's doing incredible work in the world, alpha and omega. My wife wants to get sick hearing those words. I do get the perspective of masculine and feminine potentially having such a charge with them that they can maybe repel people from maybe entering the experience. My deepest curiosity, and maybe this is a personal limitation, words help me enter an experience. Do you have a wording that can soften the blow conceptually, that can, you know, I'm looking here, you know, if I go away from this, I suppose on a practical level, if I go away from this and I go, okay, masculine, feminine, yeah, I'm feeling a shift there. I need to go beyond that or maybe drop those. Is there anything that fills the void in words, or is it just a wordless sense? Are you speaking that there's just no words? You need to just have an experience of it.
I think I would say, I would go toward that there aren't any really good words right now. And when I'm speaking to somebody, you know, if I'm speaking to a woman who just did something incredibly powerful, I'd just say, what you just did is incredibly fucking powerful. Thank you. When I'm speaking to a man who is just been kind and you know, it was about a week and a half ago, I was at a ranch and a horse had gotten very injured. And the vet who came out was a man, and he's just, I'd never met this guy before. He's like this burly big guy, could probably pick up a horse himself. But his gentleness was unbelievable. And I just, you know, I actually said to that, thank you, sir, for being so gentle. And it wasn't my horse. I just happened to be there with a friend. And so it's that. It's what I try to do is speak directly to the situation at hand. And because it's so hard to generalize, it's like, you know, it's just so hard. So it's like I try to individuate with people.
Introduction to the terms masculine and feminine always were relating with creating a sexual arc of attraction. It was utilized conceptually within myself, and I still do, as in, okay, in that moment, if I'm more in my masculine, you know, my beautiful queen is in her feminine, there's an arc of sexual charge between us. I found it very useful. My curiosity is relationally, on a practical level, what words, and again, I'm sort of smiling to myself here too. I'm going back to words. I think there's going to be a part when I listen back to this, is like, Mark, how many fucking times were you asking Dewey to give you words to just let your like academic nerdy part just sedate? So I'm sort of laughing at that, but I'm looking for words, Dewey. What words of wisdom? You've seen so many relationships, the bringing into intimacy, but what words do you have, or guidance or wisdom that comes up? And I know we're coming into landing here, so it could be like a topic for an entire conversation. I do understand that, but I'd love your perspective on sexual attraction in a conscious way. Like, what's the 3-4 minute Dewey Freeman summary of the best wisdom he has? No pressure.
No pressure. Yeah. I totally get what you're asking me. And just for you and for whomever is listening, if at some point you want to do another show, another chat, I'm more than open to that. There's 4 words that I would come up with. One is attachment and authenticity. That those two words are incredibly important. And the words that tie to attachment and authenticity are instinct and intuition. So if you could have a mind picture of like the word attachment, and like on a page underneath it is instinct, like we instinctually want to attach. Part of attachment, interestingly enough, later in life is the sexual attraction that you're talking about. That's an instinctual, incredibly powerful, both attraction and attachment. So attachment is not just between babies and parents. I have an incredibly deep attachment to Kimberly. And it's an instinctual piece. It's like, yeah, this opening between us is at times incredibly sexual. It's incredibly beautiful. Sometimes it's incredibly kind and gentle, and sometimes it's incredibly wild and crazy. And then authenticity has to do, I align that with attachment, because for true attachment to happen, we also have to be authentic. Sometimes we're put in situations where attachment is conditional, or love is conditional, we don't get to be authentic, which means we don't really have attachment. We'll still try to get attachment. And then again, in sort of a mind picture of underneath authenticity is intuition. And intuition is that inner knowing that comes from our gut that is authentic. And so what I work with in relationship is attachment, authenticity, instinct, and intuition. And those are the words it's like I have can have intuitive hits around what's happening between me and another person at any given time. If I'm completely authentic in a relationship, that actually leads to attachment. And if I'm attached in a relationship and it's a healthy relationship, it leads to authenticity. The drive of wanting connection and interconnection and the I, thou, we is instinctual. It's what drives us. And so those are the words that I use. And hope that makes a little bit of sense.
It's making total sense in a beautiful breakthrough experience I had in creating sexual attraction with my beautiful queen. Like, we're 15 years together, and I've done so much deep work conversationally, but still an edge of mine is, you know, just owning my sexual instinct there again. But I had a beautiful experience. We definitely have like our attachment needs down and authenticity. We've been radically honest like never before. I had a potent experience on the couch the other night. We were watching a movie, Dewey, and with the base of attachment and authenticity being met, we were there and Matilda just got a bit upset. Well, actually got very upset. She just looked at me and she's like, "You're just so engrossed in the film, you fucking forgot I'm here." And I was like, okay. And there was a part of me sort of going, okay, like my mind went, oh shit, this is going to be one of these conversations. How do I come back from this? But we've a good background of attachment and authenticity being available to us, and instinctually, intuitively in that moment. And I don't think I've ever done this before, but it just was like looking her direct in the eyes, "Shut up, Amore. Just kiss me." And it was perfect. It's like saying it now, it can be like, oh God, just that's like what an ignorant thing to say. But intuitively and instinctually, my nervous system just gave me that. Dewey, she was turned on for the entire night. We made love off the back of that one comment in that one moment. And it was instinct. There was no part of my mind that was like, oh, I read that in the book, this is what you meant to say. It was perfect in that moment. So yeah, I just wanted to say very quickly, you've nailed it for me experientially with those four words. Dewey, I was greedy at the end. I'm not going to make any apology for it because you're such an amazing human being. I wanted to max my time with you. Thank you. I will definitely take you up on your offer to invite you back in. Guys, I've had a rip-roaring roller coaster, beautiful wisdom ride with you. Where can guys find you online to follow up with you afterwards?
Thank you so very much. I've had an incredible experience with you. Thank you very much. I consider you a friend now. And I appreciate your invitation to come in. Pretty much, there's two places. On Instagram, it's Dewey Freeman, very simple. My one main website is deweyfreeman.org. The other one is the Gestalt Institute of the Rockies. If you just put Gestalt Institute in, or Gestalt Aquine Institute in, that will come up. Let me say that again, because I didn't say it well. GestaltAquineInstitute.com. So both of those will link in with me. If anyone wants to connect in, Kimberly, my partner, is also a therapist, and she is my partner in both of those institutes and both of those websites. She has the Colorado Ecotherapy Institute. We work together. So if you look at any of those, either of mine, you'll end up seeing her too. So feel free to follow some stuff with her. And those are the best places to get hold of me.
Dewey, brother, thank you so much for coming in. It has been an absolute joy to behold and to be in your presence for today. Thank you, brother.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Have a fantastic day, folks.
So there you have it, kingly brothers. The gauntlet has been set before us by Dewey. The challenge to us individually and collectively is to bring more conscious I, thou, and we intentionality and consciousness into our marriages, into our parenting, into our friendships, and beyond, in all human connections we have, supporting us in the deepest reason we do what we do here on a bi-weekly basis. Better husbands today, better world tomorrow. Go have an amazing, beautiful, kingly day. And before you go, kingly brothers, I'm so happy to let you know that Heroic Husbands Men's Circles waiting list is now live. Online meetings supporting you up level to hero husband status. Go from fearing your best will never be good enough to becoming the competent and confident husband she brags about. Save years of needless guesswork and confidence eroding disconnection. Click on the link in the podcast description to take your first simple step to becoming the marriage-transforming hero of your relationship. Check it out now.